ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. Thank you all for coming. I'm Keith Bradshaw with the New York Times. I'll be your host today on behalf of the professional committee. Before I introduce our guest, just a couple of housekeeping notes. First of all, please, everybody, turn off your mobiles now, or at least put them on silent. We do now video all of our speakers and put them up on the web. And in addition, we have other people filming as well. And there's nothing worse than thinking you heard that great quote and you can't quite hear it because something's beeping away. So please turn off your mobiles. Second of all, usually I use this occasion to tell you all about our events in the coming week. We don't have a lot. We deliberately don't schedule events in December because so many rooms are busy with private events. In fact, our next event won't be until January 5, which is Jaspal Bindra, the CEO of Standard Chartered in Asia. But we make an exception for our no December rule for Jerry Cohen, who's also an exception to our rule of not letting people come speak every year. He is one of our favorite speakers. I think many of you know him. He has been probably the best known American expert on the Chinese legal system for a half century. He's also been one of the top experts on Chinese foreign policy, whether it's China-Taiwan relations dating back to the 1960s, whether it was his studies in Japan in the early 1970s. And today he wants to talk about another element of Chinese foreign policy in the South China Sea. And with that, I give you Jerome Cohen. Thank you.
I'm delighted to be back here. Normally, I would like to talk about the enduring problems of human rights in China. I just came down from Beijing meeting with many of the persecuted people who are now under constrained release conditions. And of course, some, like Gao Zhisheng, may even be dead. We don't know. And the blind man, my good friend Chen Guangcheng, continues to live in indecent captivity. But I don't want to talk about that. This isn't Human Rights Day. That isn't until December 10th. But today is a different anniversary, as some of you know. I don't know how many of you recall. I was a boy playing basketball in the backyard on December 7th, which was December 8th here, 1941. And we entered a Pacific War on very unfavorable terms. So it seemed to me an appropriate time to talk about how to avert the next Pacific War and talk about these emerging disturbing problems relating to the sea. Originally, it was suggested maybe I should just talk about the very difficult questions of military activity in some other countries. Exclusive economic zone, which is maybe the most potentially incendiary question we confront with China. But I thought it's better to deal with that in a much broader context and talk about the East China Sea and the South China Sea and where the military activity question fits in. I think there's going to be a need for much more understanding about these problems in the media, and that's why I thought it's important to talk in this important forum about the questions. First, I have to note with great sadness the sudden death of my colleague in this field, John Van Dyke, who is a distinguished professor at the University of Hawaii Law School for many years. He was a student in the first course I ever gave, 1966, at Harvard Law School about international law in China, and he spent his entire life on these questions of the law of the sea, and he was admirably equipped not only in intelligence and in learning and analytical equipment, but he had a good personality. He was very balanced, very low key, and these are potentially controversial questions. And as an inveterate participant in law of the sea conferences, he always gave people the impression he wasn't some strident American voice for the US Navy, but he was a pretty objective, impartial person. He died at a Law of the Sea conference about 10 days ago in Australia. And we miss him. And this is the time when we're going to need all the sophistication, knowledge, and creativity possible to solve these difficult problems. Well, you're all familiar with the talk about the rising China being best represented by a so-called assertive policy on the Law of the Sea. We first got a whiff of this when you had the fishing trawler incident involving a Chinese captain who rammed Japanese boats off the Diaoyutai Senkaku islands and made China look very bad. I think it was a stupid move on the Chinese part because it gave the world the impression that China doesn't give a damn about international law and just wants to use power to challenge the Japanese position. And that's a mistake because China has come a long way with respect to public international law since the Cultural Revolution ended. I remember vividly on June 16th, 1972, I had a chance for a four-hour dinner with Zhou Enlai and his whole foreign affairs apparatus in Beijing. And we got along pretty well, dealt with a lot of sensitive problems, the Vietnam War and all that. I thought I could make a point for international law. And I said, you know, now that China's in the UN, they had just come into the UN October 71, this was June 72, I said, I think you should take seriously the idea of posting somebody to the International Court of Justice. Well, that caused the greatest laughter imaginable. These people thought I was a comedian, Jack Benny or somebody. They laughed. Why would China want to post anybody to the International Court of Justice, which has always been a bourgeois-dominated institution? China has never felt any confidence in international adjudication of any kind, and they just thought it was ridiculous. Well, I tried to hold my ground, and I said, I think you're soon going to want to put somebody on the ICJ. It's one of the perks of great power. And it's a status, and it's a source of influence, and you'll want to be associated with it. It took 10 years before they did it, but since then, since 82 or so, China has always had distinguished representatives on the ICJ, as it does today. And they've come a long way in training people in all aspects of international law, some of you may know. And they take it pretty seriously, and they're skilled operators in using it and in expressing national interests in international legal terms. So I was surprised when they allowed themselves to be seen by the world, I thought, inaccurately, as being people who just want to trash international law. And in actuality, the Japanese do not have a very solid position about what they call the Senkaku Islands. Their position doesn't pass the international law smell test when you talk about the merits of the case, nor does it pass the test when you talk about how should a legal dispute be resolved. The obvious way is through some International Court of Justice or the Tribunal for the Law of the Sea established by the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, or some agreed ad hoc international arbitration. But Japan's position, since it occupies these eight piles of rock they're so controversial, has been there is no dispute. How can there be a dispute since we're right? And since there's no dispute, there's no reason to answer any request for adjudication or arbitration. The Japanese position, we don't have time here to go into details, is less than, I would say, persuasive. China also has trouble in justifying its claim to the Senkaku for failure to protest after World War II, the jurisdiction assumed by the United States and ultimately in 72 by Japan. They only started when oil was thought to be found near the islands beginning 1968 by a UN survey. So the merits are mixed, but I think the Chinese position should not be dismissed because they made a bad mistake by having this trawler incident and the frightening fuss that followed when China became nationalistically angry about the reception given to the trawler captain. Well, since then, things have calmed down, fortunately, in the East China Sea, but part of the reason may be this rising tide of concern because of China's claims to the South China Sea. Now, one has to be careful in addressing those claims because the first thing is we don't really know what they are in detail. A lot of noise is made by different representatives of Chinese organizations, but not in a formally official statement normally. So maybe a Xinhua representative will say this, or some general will say that, and it's not clear, in other words, precisely what is China claiming in the South China Sea. Second, it's certainly not clear what the legal basis for whatever claim it has is. Are they saying historically this is ours, like the Gulf of Bohai off Tianjin? Are they saying we own all the islands and we should have straight baselines encompassing all the islands? Are they saying this is part of our territorial sea for all the islands we own, and we also have an exclusive economic zone, and by the way, we also have the rights to the continental shelf? International law of the sea is complicated, but we just get sort of general vague statements that have made the neighboring states understandably increasingly anxious. And this has caused a reaction, of course, that's very dangerous. We have seen in the last year, especially in recent months, a number of U.S. Reactions, often at the behest of states that now don't have such a rosy view of their neighbor China. It's looking like, are we going to resurrect the John Foster Dulles 1950s ring of China encircling China through a series of bilateral military agreements? And many people in China are beginning to worry, and we can say the situation is very different, but the fact is, to some people, they're entitled to feel this is suspicious. What are we up to? So we're approaching a point in our international relations involving the US, but also other countries in the region, including Japan and India, where the Obama administration looks very different and looks differently at China from the way it looked in 2009 when it came into office. 2010. And my hope is what we're doing is like kicking the mule, trying to get the attention of the Chinese leadership and saying, do you see what you're doing? Take another look at your international legal position and let's calm down and maybe we can reach some progress. Well, we always say heaven is wonderful. The problem is how do you get there? And we haven't seen much constructive suggestions for moving this process away from danger and toward some reasonable settlements. It's not possible to settle all these questions at once. They're highly complicated. They involve a number of claimants. And I think we have to have some orderly agenda for addressing them. First of all, I think it's important that we not focus on the islands, that we not focus on territory. Nationalism gets very excited about ownership, even of spits of land, which some of these things are. I think it's important to try to get countries, including Japan, to take a consistent position that these piles of rock are not really islands. And under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, they're not entitled to a 200-mile economic zone in addition to a 12-mile territorial sea around them. And they're not entitled to say they have a continental shelf. We ought to recognize before the island territorial questions are settled that they're of very limited significance. The name of the game is how should the sea boundaries be erected? And I think that has to come through negotiation, although it's possible the parties could go to any one of a number of tribunals. Some people suggest that's the way politicians should get rid of a sensitive question. Send it to the International Court of Justice or the International Tribunal on the Law of the Sea. That will take 10 years, and that will cool things down. And then if you lose, you can say, well, you know, we didn't have the case. That would be good in principle. I can't oppose it. I believe in international law. But it just won't work in practice because China still doesn't want to yield the decision-making with these issues to a tribunal that it can't influence. Mediation is difficult enough for China concerned with face to accept, certainly not American mediation, but adjudication I think would be unacceptable. But there is a way out here that would be congenial to China's practice and that to the other countries in the region. And that's to start negotiating one by one these problems. What is insufficiently realized is China and Vietnam, not long ago, set a good precedent for this. In 2004, China and Vietnam, with little publicity, agreed to share the waters of the Gulf of Tonkin. Between them. This was a bilateral negotiation. China, for whatever reason, made a generous settlement. Vietnam was happy with it. And you'd think this is what they should be building on. Because here it is. It is always this discussion, should it be a bilateral negotiation with each country or one big multilateral negotiation where the countries could band together to resist China's claims and the U.S. might be helpful in standing behind them. I think in the end, there'll be a combination. Diplomats are pretty imaginative people when they have to be. I would start with the Paracel Islands, the islands near Vietnam and China, not with the southern Spratly Islands, where it's much more complicated because you have more claimants, more islands, etc. And I would see whether China and Vietnam can reach a mutually agreeable settlement, and I think they should be able to do that. Now, some people say, while that process is underway, parties shouldn't wait. They should go ahead and have some joint ventures that will cooperatively exploit the resources of the sea. And that would be good, but it's a little hard to do if you haven't got an agreement about sea boundaries. I can see you could even postpone decision-making on who owns those islands if you could agree on how the waters around them should be parceled out, even if the immediate ones around the islands are left open. It's harder for me to see how you can go ahead with oil exploration and development or even fisheries development without some agreement on the sea boundaries. So my hope is that this is the way the process will start, and then it will proceed southward. You may have to have a trilateral negotiation with Malaysia and Vietnam about certain areas of the sea that they both jointly claim, including the continental shelf, jointly having this negotiation with China. But I think it can't all be done at once. But it should get started. Too much time is really wasting with generalized statements that are getting increasingly heated. I think that the Philippines and China could start a bilateral discussion. Same thing can be said, of course, even with Brunei. You could have constructed an ad hoc international group to which the individual negotiating parties could report. So there, you could combine, in effect, the demand for some multilateral forum to put pressure on China with a series of bilateral discussions that could lead to the resolution of these problems. I think Japan has to play a role here. It's interested, of course, in freedom of navigation, just as the United States is. And Japan, I think, has been pushing too hard on its view of international law. It not only has, I think, as I've indicated, an unpersuasive position on the Senkaku Diaoyutai, but there's even a spit of land called Okinotorishima that at high tide is barely visible. And nevertheless, the Japanese claim they own this spit of land. That's not contested. But they claim not only should it have a 12-mile territorial limit, but it should have an exclusive economic zone, and indeed even a part of the continental shelf. And this is ludicrous. And Japan discredits its own sometimes persuasive claims on other issues involving the law of the sea by pressing too far. So my thought is each of the countries involved has to start making some adjustments. The U.S. hasn't even ratified the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. We do claim most of its rules are followed by us because they represent customary international law. But until our Senate gets off the dime and agrees to ratify the treaty, we're in a poor position to talk about how it should be applied. So each of the countries involved, and indeed Taiwan itself, has to decide what to do. Taiwan's in an interesting but possibly positive place. On the one hand, Taiwan, claiming still to represent all of China, can't show a less tough position in asserting Chinese national claims than the PRC does. On the other hand, Taiwan can certainly sympathize with how things look from the ASEAN countries' point of view, and Taiwan wants to win sport from them. So they're in a difficult position. Taiwan also has a lot of expertise on these questions. And now that we have good cross-strait relations, Taiwan is in a position to discuss these questions with the people in Beijing. Just as Lien Zhan, formerly the leader of the Kuomintang, made some progress initially with cross-strait relations through his own so-called Track 2 talks. I didn't think they were much Track 2 when you're talking to the leadership of China, even if they use their communist hats instead of their government hats when they talk to you. But he proved to be a pretty useful player. And I think there's a role for him, or people who also have access to the Chinese leaders, from people from Taiwan, to try to talk these questions over with them and talk about what would a reasonable set of claims be and what would a reasonable process for negotiating these things be. America will never be accepted as a mediator. When Hillary Clinton suggested that, that was not exactly a goodwill gesture. But Taiwan would never claim it's a mediator, it can't. And it would be embarrassing, but de facto, Taiwan could play a role here between the conflicting claimants of Southeast Asia and Beijing. So I think there's room here for imaginative efforts. Finally, I should say something. When you get done with the territorial questions and the exclusive economic zones and the allocation of continental shelf, you're left with the question, what are the legal consequences of this arrangement? As I said at the outset, the most dangerous immediate thing we confront is there could be any day another flare-up, like the plane crash of April Fool's Day 2001, or like the 2009 one involving an American ship, Impeccable, that was provoked by a number of Chinese ships that they would claim were defending their right. The issue here is, does a country that has an exclusive economic zone beyond its territorial sea, does it have a right to say to other countries, you may not conduct any military activities? The two kinds of military activities that are in question are one, reconnaissance, airplanes or ships getting near the shore of China in order to learn what's going on inside China, or mapping the sea bottom, which you could see eventually could have security implications as well as communications and transportation of a less concerning nature. This was thrashed out at the Law of the Sea conference that led to the convention. China at that point did not take a position on this. A minority of states did say, this isn't just an exclusive economic zone, but it's broad enough to prohibit any reconnaissance or seabed mapping. Well, that argument lost. Most countries rejected it. But China in recent years has become the most outspoken, you might say, advocate of that view, and has put its money where its mouth is occasionally. This is dangerous. The U.S., which often talks a better game than it acts in international law terms, on this issue has a pretty good position, I think. Our view is we have a right in other countries' economic zones to engage in peaceful reconnaissance and even seabed mapping. And we not only insist that others recognize it, but we recognize it vis-a-vis the similar activities of others in our area, and that seems to be the case. Russia, for example, sometimes does do reconnaissance offshore the United States in our exclusive economic zone, and the U.S. position is we do not prohibit it, we don't try to stop it, we do monitor it. We're watching what they do, but they have a right to do it. So it's a question of theory and practice. It's also reported that China frequently engages in similar reconnaissance activities offshore Japan and even offshore Vietnam. You don't get much focus on this. The information about Japan seems to be more frequently available than that relating to Chinese activities offshore Vietnam. And it may be the Chinese justify this by saying we haven't settled our boundary claims with Japan. We're only doing this in waters that are rightfully ours. But there is an important issue here for countries to adjust their theory to their practice. And you can't say, do as I say, not as I do. So this has to be worked out. Now, we do have a continuing mechanism for talks with China about this. Our militaries discuss this regularly in an attempt to avoid any further incidents, but we're not getting anywhere. And we're not getting anywhere because it's hard for China to make arrangements how to deal with the safety aspects of American reconnaissance offshore China if we say it's illegitimate to do that. They don't want to recognize implicitly, at least, our right to engage in these activities. So this is a very dangerous area. I think there's got to be some kind of understanding and compromise here. And it's the one on which there seems to be the least light. My hope is some progress will be made, but I have the least idea of how this is going to be handled compared to all the other issues involved. So we have a lot of questions. I'm hoping that my talk today will inspire some interest, not only among journalists or academics, but also more generally concerned people. And it seems to be a highly appropriate topic on the 70th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. So I welcome your comments, and as they say in Beijing, comrades, give me your criticisms.
Thank you very much. And actually, if I can give you one question or criticism right off, which is that you talk about calling for bilateral talks initially between China and Vietnam, then between, for example, China and the Philippines. And to some extent, people have been worrying that that's exactly what the United States has been afraid of, that some of the, for example, in a China-Philippines bilateral talk, the Philippines has very little leverage. It might be hard for it to stand up to. Why not leave a role, for example, for ASEAN and for some kind of multilateral process, at least for the Spratlys, if not for the Paracels?
Well, the trouble is ASEAN has 10 members. Only four of them are actively involved here. I think you need some sort of ad hoc mechanism. But one can't ignore the fact that Vietnam and China successfully resorted to bilateral negotiations, even though China is much more powerful. And they reached an equitable result. So I think it's worth a try. The Philippines can always resist what it regards as undue claims by China. Publicity is very important. It could then enlist the support of other states, including those that aren't claimants among ASEAN, including the US and Japan. But let's jump off that bridge when we get to it. I would say start with the negotiation. China's under a lot of pressure now to look more reasonable. It has made a major blunder in the South China Sea. It's reaping the consequences now. The new leadership that will take effect a year from now in the Politburo Standing Committee will have to cope with this. It may be the current leaders in their remaining year are just too lame ducks to do much about it, but I don't think so. I think even they are showing some signs of awareness that they've gone too far. They're surprised at how indignant people have become, and I think the leadership has allowed too many officials in China, some of them nationalistic, some of them military-minded, to make statements that appear to represent the country. But the government in its official statement can pull back from this because it's never put itself on the line. The very ambiguity of its claims and the failure to justify them leaves them open and flexible to make much more reasonable claims. So I think it's important not to keep theorizing and looking for sudden all-purpose resolution of these things, but to get on with the process step by step. And I would start building on the Gulf of Tonkin precedent and letting China and Vietnam see what they can do vis-a-vis the Paracels.
Okay, with that, people can try to introduce themselves, please.
Hi, thanks, Professor Cohen. I'm Greg Terode of the South China Morning Post. I'm very interested to hear your remarks on the Paracels. Isn't one of the problems with the Paracels that Vietnam is asking China to negotiate it as part of their bilateral relationship, but China, like Japan and the Senkakus, is saying, we occupy it, nothing is in dispute here?
You see, in every one of these incidents, whether it's the Japanese-Korean dispute over Takashima, or whether it's the Senkaku-Diaoyutai, China-Japan-Taiwan dispute, or whether it's the current one here, the occupying power is very reluctant to recognize that there's a dispute. They don't want to. They say, you know, occupation is 90% of the game. Japan is totally inconsistent. It wants to go to some international adjudication with the Takto Takashima because it doesn't occupy the place. It does occupy the Senkaku, so it says there's no dispute. We don't have to. I think the situation is reaching, has reached the stage where countries have to be consistent in what they preach and what they practice. You can't get away these days in our information age with a totally inconsistent posture. And I think let's put China to the test. Vietnam, of course, has an additional grievance over the Paracels, because on two occasions, China used force to gain occupation of part of the Paracels. And China may deny that it used force, but the rest of the world knows that. They took advantage of a declining South Vietnamese government in 1974 to push them off certain islands. And that adds to the tension and background of grievance and resentment. But I think all these countries are worried now. Everybody's got to start making some concessions. And let's put the Chinese to the test. Do they really believe in peaceful settlement? I think there's a chance that they may. We have a new leader who's going to be prime minister of China, apparently, beginning March of 2013. Li Keqiang, who was the first law school graduate, authentic law school graduate, Peking University Law School class of 1982, when he finished. Let's see whether he could be persuaded to deal with this. It's a lot easier, I think, for him to deal with this question than the question of human rights in China.
Get the microphone there, please.
Hi, Albert Lin here of China Energy Fund. Is the U.S. a signatory to the U.N. Convention on the Law of the Sea? And if not, why not?
The U.S.?
Yes.
Well, you know, the U.S. government, executive branch, I think under both parties, has advocated ratification. I think many influential American groups would like to see ratification. The Senate seems to be very reluctant for a variety of reasons, perhaps based in American nationalism and fear of the Law of the Sea Treaty and certain conventions. Originally, there was certain provisions. Originally, there was concern about how to mine for certain mineral nodules at the basis of the sea, and would we not be able to have free access to our industry getting access to those minerals. There are different industries that see themselves as possibly affected, but I think our administrations haven't, again, been vigorous enough. We've been so preoccupied with so many other questions. The law of the sea until recently has not seemed a high priority, but as part of our so-called pivot or return or reassertion of our interest in East Asia, I think we're going to have to address the law of the sea question. We're in a poor position if we don't ratify it. I'd like to see President Obama take a position on this. I don't think it would prove adverse to his election campaign. Of course, it would be ideal if we could get the Republican Party, once it stops cutting itself up in the primaries, to take a similar position, and we might. But I'm very unhappy about the U.S. being in this peculiar position.
Joel, quick question here, please.
Joel Lakin, representing, in this instance, the IPPF, Independent Power Producers Forum. I'm sure glad you brought up minerals and offshore resources, because this dispute will, of course, eventually be resolved. And how it's resolved certainly will impact eventually on the issues that impact on offshore oil, mainly offshore gas, a la Vietnam and other countries, because there's lots of discussions over rights in those areas. And will this be impacting, I'm sure, on the resolution of this current dispute?
I don't think existing commercial interests in oil and gas or fisheries or minerals of any kind should impede these negotiations. Indeed, if the negotiations are successful, this will make it simpler to conclude agreements. And oil companies, for example, that have been stymied by China making threatening remarks or gestures about Vietnam's attempt to negotiate contracts with offshore oil companies, I think sea boundary delimitation will now make it possible. It will remove a very great friction. It may be possible even to have Sino-Vietnamese official participation of their oil companies with Western or other Japanese or what have you oil companies. But without a resolution of disputes, the oil companies will remain frustrated, as will other commercial interests.
Okay, we have one more question here. Oh, somebody had a hand up. Yes, over here, please.
Hi, Ted Kavoris from Panoramic. I think what we fail to acknowledge is that China is basically using fishing vessels as missiles to crash into boats that they don't want in their area of control. And I think that is a true aggression on their behalf. And I don't see any acknowledgement of that, I think, ill-fated policy.
Well, I think that was what was behind the concern about the unfortunate trawler incident. You can't say with any confidence that that trawler captain was just a private fishing person. Certainly, with the crash involving the Impeccable in 2009, nobody was under the illusion that these were just private commercial boats. This is one of, as they used to say, Pretty Fanny's ways. It's just something you can't take too seriously. These are unfortunate ways of China calling attention to the fact it's not getting from other countries what it wants. It makes a fuss over the Senkaku because China believes it should be the occupying territorial power there. It makes a fuss over American reconnaissance efforts because the U.S. refuses to yield to China's claim that these efforts are illegitimate. And of course, you're right, it's not exactly a friendly way of dealing with the dispute, but they regard it as small potatoes. It's just an incident that, if properly viewed, calls attention to a bigger problem they're frustrated about, and the world is not going their way.
Did the Chinese suspension for 2 months of rare earth metals exports to Japan for 2 months during the trawler dispute in any way hurt their legal claim? You mentioned that use of force can actually undermine maybe claims, for example, in 1974. What about that that unannounced but very clear embargo?
Well, again, that was a bad mistake on China's part. It has diminished their monopoly. A number of countries, including our own, are taking measures to try no longer to be left in a position where the helpless creatures of a Chinese 95% monopoly of rare metals. Again, what should have been a subtle gesture got out of control with certain denials. The whole thing was embarrassing. Look, despite China's expertise in international law, it doesn't guarantee that its officials will always behave in the most enlightened way. You could say that about the United States in spades, of course, whether you talk about our invasion of Iraq or our refusal to honor decisions of the International Court of Justice, as happened in Central America. China is behaving like other major powers, learning to manipulate international law, occasionally making mistakes in its application. But I think we should recognize that international law and negotiation combined, not law alone, but negotiation combined with appropriate political backing that I think has certainly emerged now with the United States and other countries, can be a solution and get us over a rough patch. The hardest problem I see is this failure to agree on military reconnaissance in the exclusive economic zones.
It's 2 o'clock, but thank you all very much for coming. We like to give our guests something to remember the club by. In your case, Jerry, I think you probably have an entire wardrobe of FCC garments, but here's another one.
Thank you, I can always
do. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming, and we hope to see you, I guess, January 5th in the new year for Jaspal Bindra of Standard Chartered. Bye-bye.